A critical legislative deadline has come and gone. From SDPB, today is Wednesday, February 26th, and this is In the Moment. We check in with reporters and lawmakers about priorities for Crossover Day. It's the day bills must pass from their initial chamber and cross over to the other. Otherwise, they'll never see the governor's desk. Two SDPB reporters have their eyes on where legislators sit on prison funding and eminent domain. Our Dakota political junkie talks education. Plus, Representative Pri Poirier joined me in the Capitol. We're broadcasting today from SDPB's SDN Communications Studio in Pier. I'm Jackie Hendry, in for Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Jackie Hendry, in today for Lori Walsh. And joining me in SDPB's SDN Communications Studio in the Capitol Building in Pier is Lee Strubinger. He's SDPB's politics and public policy reporter, and he joins me now to break down the ongoing saga of prison funding. Lee, welcome back.
Hey, Jackie. Thanks for being here.
Couldn't let you have all the fun.
Right.
So this has been an ongoing conversation, this prison funding. Even just earlier this week, we had maybe a bit of a plot twist in that. Bring listeners up to speed. What's the latest with that funding?
I think what is very evident right now is that support to authorize construction of the current proposal for the men's prison, the 1,500-bed facility at a maximum price of $825 million, it just does not have the support it needs to pass in the state house. You know, questions kind of remain about the Senate, but in terms of whether or not it would pass the South Dakota House of Representatives, it's not going to happen because it needs two-thirds majority support. There's a lot of skepticism about that particular proposal. What we saw on Friday and also on Monday were failed attempts to basically take the kind of idea of the authorization funding, but just what the administration wanted to do in terms of transferring some one-time dollars into the Incarceration Construction Fund, which is a big pot of money that lawmakers in the past have wanted to use to fund what will be a very large expense, could be the largest expense in state history, or at least this current proposed idea would have been. Mm-hmm. And so in many ways, that funding transfer on Friday and on Monday also felt like a referendum on the project, and so that idea really stalled in the House. It came down to a vote of 35-35, essentially, at the end, which is not the majority needed to even just pass that funding transfer. Mm-hmm. So that kind of stalled there. And then what you saw in the state Senate's Senate State Affairs Committee on Monday morning was a bill to authorize another task force to look at this particular idea, the proposals, and, you know, even kind of tucked in there was ways to look at how to reduce recidivism, which we have a very high recidivism rate within our correction system right now.
Right. So this funding mechanism had, you know, obviously very, very full support from former Governor Noem, full support from Governor Rodin. Seemed to have full support really last session. This was really a conversation leading up to this session that we really thought we were going to get this done. Do we have any ideas of what the holdup is for the folks voting no?
I think part of the holdup is just concern about the project in general and the way that it's kind of moved forward. It's caused a lot of discomfort for lawmakers, this kind of new majority of Republican lawmakers. And so, you know, while corrections has gone in front of appropriations when lawmakers are not in session, sort of give updates about not only the women's prison that's being built in Rapid City currently, but also where things are at with the men's prison, there still is a feeling among this new majority, a kind of consternation about the project idea, and it doesn't feel like it's been entirely transparent to them. You know, this is a very conservative legislature, and $825 million is a lot of money to spend, and many expect that project to be even more, and so they don't feel like corrections is being entirely forthright about this particular project right now. So that's like part of the holdup among the kind of folks who are in charge right now.
Yeah. So how do you see this issue playing out into really the broader landscape of this 100th legislative session?
I think what you're seeing right now is a kind of, I'm trying to find the right word here, but basically there's a lot of consternation about several projects that move forward under Governor Kristi Noem, whether it's this particular prison project or you have the kind of these like one-stop buildings in Rapid City and Sioux Falls, and there are particulars about those projects that have to do with the amount of money that the buildings cost and the kind of leasing agreements that the state entered into that many lawmakers in this new majority don't feel are very fair or are good budget decisions. And then you also have projects that were done by the Department of Game, Fish, and Parks that legislators voted no time and time again over a proposed shooting range. And that project still ended up moving forward despite the legislature voting those things down. And so there are some bills that are being proposed right now by the Republican Senate President Pro Tem, Chris Carr, to kind of reel in the executive branch in terms of moving forward on a lot of those projects. So I think that's like really what we're kind of seeing is sort of a reaction to those projects moving forward. And then obviously you can't discount how massive and big the proposed carbon pipeline project was and is, and how that's really hung over session as well.
Right. Before we let you go, the crossover day really marks kind of the back half of the legislative session. What are you looking forward to in these remaining days?
Well, I think some of the things that we're going to see are some real negotiations starting to take place in terms of what lawmakers want a kind of property tax relief package to look like. There are several proposals out there. Some of them are competing. Some of them are sort of go together. And I think we'll really start to see that initiative start to really kind of coalesce as they figure out what they want that to look like. And then also I'll be watching what happens with the state budget as the Appropriations Committee really starts to piece that together. They'll start doing these things called motion sheets that really sort of, now that they have like a number that they can work with, they'll start fitting in all the departments and sort of what kind of funding levels look like. And I think of interest to our listeners, you know, SDPB's budget will be included in that, and we'll be watching it.
Right. SDPB's Lee Strubinger, thanks for your time.
You bet, Jackie.
And now SDPB's CJ Keen sits down with me in our peer studio. Hi, CJ.
Hi, Jackie. Happy to be here.
What are you working on?
So right now I'm following two bills that are kind of connected regarding eminent domain, which of course has been one of the biggest property rights battles that's been happening in South Dakota for a really long time. I guess we can start right there with Senate Bills 49 and 198. 49 is dead. That has been killed for some time. And 198 just narrowly made it out of the Senate on a single vote. And if there's one thing that you'll notice in peer this year, it's a lot of one vote differences in both sides of the House and in committees.
Right. What are some of the comments you're hearing that are really making the difference in these issues?
So it really depends on where you fall. For example, with this eminent domain bill, 49 was brought by Piedmont Republican Senator John Carley, who's a member of a more, I guess, hardline property rights group who is definitely fighting to stick to their guns. No eminent domain for private gain. And they are dying on that hill if they have to. Whereas on the other end of the spectrum, you have the Jim Melhoff bill, Senate Bill 198. That bill is definitely more of a middle ground.
Since I got to this chamber in January of 2023, landowner rights and the use of eminent domain has been an ongoing and a pretty prickly debate that's been going on around our state. And it pits two things together, the public's needs for critical infrastructure like highways, railroads, pipelines, natural gas, oil, water, etc., and other developments that serve the public interest. And how you balance between these two, the land rights versus the public interest for this infrastructure. You go too much in one direction, the government and common carriers can just trample all over landowner rights and basically have their way with them. If you go too much the other way, you wind up in a stalemate where you can't build anything. You can't have any economic development, and you can't get anything built that's in the public interest.
And I think that's what's making these narrow differences a lot of the time. And that bill would require a mediation process before eminent domain could be declared by, say, a pipeline company.
Okay. What are we seeing for the future of these bills? What's the vibe on the ground?
The vibe on the ground is Senate Bill 49 is dead. It was killed in committee. Mainly on the back of it was very, very narrow and objectively targeted CO2 and hydrogen pipelines. Senator Jim Melhoff said that that was a problem. He says that he sees that as a problem in a similar House bill, whereas the broader scope, 198, seemed to get a little bit more support, especially in a bipartisan way, which, you know, in a committee that's that narrow, it can make a difference. Ultimately, that contributed to 49's failure and 198's success. It's maybe not the most popular among landowners because the harder line coalition has a very strong contingent of people who come in and battle tooth and nail for these bills. So you can't say that there's no support for a more intense bill right now, but when it comes to meeting somewhere in the middle, perfect is the enemy of good, a wise man once said.
As lawmakers were approaching that crossover deadline, we were seeing a lot of votes earlier this week. How did you see some of those play out?
Senate Bill 198 received a motion to reconsider Monday, and that once again passed by a single vote. And that one vote difference may seem like just a little bit, but there may have been a little theatrical flair at the end. There's a very common, every single bill gets this, are there any questions on the titles? And usually, because of course there aren't, nobody says anything, but Senator Carley stands up and, I have it written down here, proposes amending the title to forcing mediation for abuse of eminent domain. That was very quickly point of ordered, and Lieutenant Governor Van Huysen agreed with the point of order, and that was shut down.
Mr. President, we have 18 yeas, 17 nays.
So Senate Bill 198, having received an affirmative vote of a majority of the members-elect, the President declared the bill passed. Are there any questions on the title?
Yes, Mr. President.
You have a question on the title?
Yes, Mr. President. I feel the title is not correct. I have an amendment to the title.
Is it a written amendment?
No, it's not published, but it's short. Perhaps we could amend from the floor.
State your amendment.
Mr. President, I would like to amend the title to, quote, forcing mediation for more abuse of eminent domain.
Who had a point of order? Senator Smith, state your point of order. I'm going to rule the title amendment. I'm going to agree with your point of order, rule that out of order. I think the title encompasses the content of the bill in its current form.
So, like I asked Lee, crossover day really marks kind of the waning days of the legislative session. In your reporting, what are you looking forward to in these last few days of the 100th legislative session?
In the last few days, I definitely am interested in seeing how the prison goes. I'm interested in seeing budget restrictions. But there's other things that go beyond the legislative session. Summer studies, summer talks between lawmakers and advocacy groups. A bill that I followed very briefly, because it is now dead, is House Bill 1137. That was brought by Representative Brian Mulder, and it would have established the pain parity system in opiates, in opiate prescription. Again, this bill was killed, but on the request of Mulder, who says that he wants to have summer talks, maybe involve it in some kind of summer study, but definitely do some more research before we bring a bill like this to the floor of the House and Senate, just to make sure South Dakota gets the best possible bill.
You can find full reporting from Lee Strubinger and CJ Keene online at sdpb.org/news. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Jackie Hendry in for Lori Walsh. We're entering the home stretch of the legislative session in Pierre, and what happens here can impact South Dakotans in their homes, in their workplace, in their communities, and of course, their classrooms. Seth Tupper is editor-in-chief of South Dakota Searchlight, and he joins me now from SDPB's Black Hills Surgical Hospital studio in Rapid City. Hi, Seth. Thanks for being here.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So I want to start off, Seth, you had a commentary piece come out recently saying it's not hard to figure out why young South Dakotans don't want to be teachers. And it seems like this was spurred on by some conversation during the legislative session. Why don't you set the stage for us with what prompted you to write this piece?
Yeah, what triggered that, I was in Pierre a week earlier this session and attended an appropriations, a joint appropriations committee meeting, the main budget committee of the legislature, where the Board of Regents came in and made a presentation, and several university presidents came in and made their presentations. And as the director of the Board of Regents, Nathan Lucas, was going through his presentation, he had some slides about the number of graduates that were coming out of various programs, how many accountants and engineers, et cetera, that, that the state university programs are graduating every year and sending into the workforce. And one of the slides talked about the number of teachers. And a legislator, I don't remember who it was now, interrupted with a question and asked Nathan Lucas, you know, why aren't we graduating as many teachers as we used to? And Nathan Lucas gave the answer that, well, it's there just isn't the interest anymore. He said that, you know, if you compare to 10, 20, 30 years ago, the number of high school students that are coming into college wanting to be teachers is a lot less than it used to be. And immediately, there wasn't much discussion after that, but immediately my mind went to all of these bills we've seen this year and recent years, past years, that really have been, I guess I would describe them as trying to put some onerous mandates or at least mandates on public education without any additional funding. And of course, you know, funding for public education is a perpetual fight and struggle in this state. So the commentary took off from there and laid out a bunch of the bills this session and in the past few years and things that I thought maybe was creating an environment, as I described it in the commentary, that was sort of hostile to public education and would maybe dissuade people from going into the teaching profession.
Mm-hmm. And in past conversations, I think the last number I heard yesterday on the House floor, something I don't remember the exact number, it was something around 200, more than 200 open teaching positions right now throughout the state of South Dakota. That's been a topic of conversation for a while. A lot of times this conversation leans into teacher pay, but you're seeing kind of additional layers on top of that. I wonder if you can just kind of talk through some of your past coverage of education in that realm, that pay versus pipeline versus political atmosphere.
Yeah, well, and I know a lot of people don't want to talk about this and they're tired of talking about it and it's a perpetual issue, but it I think it does start with pay. You know, as many people may remember, South Dakota increased its sales tax, state sales tax rate from 4 to 4.5%, I think 9 years ago, ostensibly for the purpose of raising teacher pay, and we accomplished some gains. And then we lost focus, and we sit here today, we're 49th in average teacher salary. And you hear people complain about that every legislative session and say they want to do something about it. We never seem to get any real traction with that. So I think it does start there. And then you start layering things on top of it. When I go into my kids' public schools here in Rapid City, there's a giant sign on the wall that says, "In God We Trust," because in 2019, the legislature in its wisdom thought that we needed to require every school to post that sign. So they did that, which is, you know, I argued in the commentary, which was, you know, instead of tackling real problems in education, I don't think anybody really thinks by requiring schools to post a sign on the wall that you're really tackling real problems in education. And you layer on top of that, you know, similar efforts this year that ended up failing to require every public school classroom to post a copy of the Ten Commandments and to post a copy of the state motto, "Under God the People Rule." You layer that in, you start layering in other things like the social studies standards controversy of a couple of years ago when, you know, an initial working group was shut down and the governor was involved, then Governor Noem, in reappointing people to a new working group. And some of those people appeared to have sort of an ideological alignment that she preferred. And so it kind of politicized the social studies standards process. This year, there's a big fight over school choice with three bills that arose and ultimately failed to try to peel away millions of dollars in state funds to direct toward private education options like homeschooling and private school tuition, et cetera. And public school lobbyists had to fight those off. And when they did that, then some legislators got mad and dropped a bill in that, that would have made it illegal for public for school boards to hire lobbyists with public funds. And so, again, and there's more, you know, more than that. And you just start layering in all that stuff. And that was kind of my point in the commentary was, gee, I wonder why people don't want to be teachers in this state, because it just seems like there's such a concerted effort year after year to do things to make life more difficult for public schools in this state while not giving them any more money to do those difficult things.
So, Seth, I know when I got started in reporting in South Dakota, I started as an education reporter, and during the legislative conversations, I got real familiar real quick with this idea of local control. And we hear this pretty frequently in most education discussions, that idea that the local school districts or local school boards should be the ones to make a lot of these decisions. How does that idea play into a lot of the conversations you hear? Because we are increasingly, as you say, seeing those bills putting certain mandates and various things onto school districts. So how does local control play in?
Well, I think there still are some legislators who truly do believe in local control, and that belief helped fight off some of these bills this session, like the one that tried to require posting 10 commandments in every classroom and things like that. You heard that from some legislators who pointed out, you know, there's already a law in the books allowing schools to post the 10 commandments if they so choose. And they said, you know, we don't need a mandate. We can have local control, and they can choose to do it or not. But I think there's a growing number of legislators, and there's quite a few legislators in the new crop that came in with this legislative session that feel like, you know, local control should be subjugated in some instances to what they believe are broader concerns, and some of those concerns are morality based or whatever. But there's no doubt that mandating every classroom in the state to post the 10 commandments is not local control. You know, it's the opposite of it. And so for some legislators, I do believe local control is a true belief. For others, I think it's just something that you use as rhetoric when it's convenient to advance your argument, and then other times you ignore it. If you truly believed in local control, I don't think you'd be filing a bill that said, you know, every single public school classroom in the state had to have a specific thing on its wall.
And I also want to point out, really, it seems to be growing momentum behind either homeschooling, alternative education. Kristi Noem, former Governor Kristi Noem, mentioning this education savings account plan in her budget address that also had support from Governor Larry Rodin, this kind of idea of, you know, outside education, outside of that public sphere, getting public dollars. Where do you see that playing into this ongoing conversation when it comes to public school teachers?
Yeah, I think that's driving a lot of the conflict right now. We had a great series by our reporter Mackenzie Huber a while back, just before the legislative session, on looking at the growth in alternative instruction, whether it's homeschooling or micro schools or private schools or pods and all these kind of new things that came out of the pandemic as new ways to do education, and people discovering that you can do some classes online and you can take some classes at your local public school and you can do some homeschooling, you can mix and match or whatever. And there's been tremendous growth in that. And part of that was fueled not only by, you know, changes wrought by the pandemic and people looking at different ways of doing schools, but also the legislature in past sessions deregulating a lot of that area. And so, the proposals this session, the various kinds of proposals that some people would just label as the with the catch-all term of vouchers, but whether you call them education savings accounts or whatever, there was another proposal to do property tax credits for people who do private education or homeschooling. All of that flows out of partly out of this movement toward, you know, different options other than public schools. And I don't think that's going anywhere. I mean, I think this year that debate was tamped down a little bit by the fact that, you know, it was a tight budget year, and some legislators who might otherwise be inclined to approve some of those ideas weren't this year because there wasn't extra money to spend for it. But you got to assume those will be back next year and maybe multiple years until they gain some headway. And I think that's driving a lot of the debate. Again, going back to this sort of new crop of legislators. There's a lot of new legislators this year. Quite a number of them seem to have some interest in alternative instruction or have connections to homeschooling or private schooling, and seem to want to come up with a way to direct some public funds to those options. And so I don't think they're gonna quit with that effort by any means.
In a lot of ways, it's almost like the ultimate local control. Like, forget the school boards. We want it in the hands of parents and families as directly as possible, really seems to be kind of the attitude that has been rising out of a lot of these conversations. I don't know if that's what you're picking on, too.
Yeah, that is an interesting way to look at it, because I mean, some of the same legislators are the ones who are, you know, arguing that they should have local control over their own child's education and be able to direct tax dollars where they want to support that education, even if it's, you know, private school or whatever. Some of those same legislators are the ones who are introducing and supporting the bills requiring publics putting mandates on public schools, like you have to post the Ten Commandments in every classroom. So it's, again, this idea of local control, is it, do you really believe in that, or is it just some rhetoric that you bring up when it's convenient to advance your argument, and that you ignore when it's not convenient?
Right. And we're gonna touch on those tax conversations, because it is really kind of hand in hand with these education conversations. But before we pivot to that, I just want to highlight a quote that you used to really close out this commentary on the teacher shortage from Rob Munson, who is the executive director of the School Administrators of South Dakota. And the quote you use from Rob Munson says, "Public education is absolutely what made this country what it is. If we lose public education, we will lose this country." And I just wonder if you can reflect a bit on Rob Munson's position there and why you decided to close out your commentary with that quote.
Yeah, and we actually had South Dakota News Media Association, which is, you know, historically the newspaper association, which we're a member of at South Dakota Searchlight. We had a news media day recently at the Capitol, and we actually brought in Rob Munson and also Majority Leader Scott Odenbach from the House, who's a major supporter of education savings accounts and those other options. And we heard from both of them on school choice. And so that's where Rob made that comment to a room full of newspaper people, basically. And I think he brings up a great point, because a lot of times that's lost, that, you know, the people who are advocating for other options like education savings accounts, vouchers, tax credits, et cetera, to support private education, a lot of times they base their argument in a criticism of public schools and the problems in public schools. Test scores and problem finding teachers and funding problems and all that. And it sort of obscures the fact that if you look at the, you know, in the grand scope, that public education is an incredible, amazing success story in this country, that the idea that, you know, every child in this country at least has the opportunity to get a quality public education, no matter what's your background, your race, your income level, whatever. Obviously, we know that there are problems in public schools, and not every public school is great, and not every teacher is great, but by and large, the idea is that we offer every child in this country the chance for a quality, free public education, the opportunity. And, you know, that's, you know, can solve a lot of problems. When we talk about having to build prisons, and we talk about wanting to create economic development, we talk about wanting to raise the next generation of leaders and government and politics, all of that ties back to school and creating a quality school experience for the most kids that we can. So I think that's, you know, what Rob, he could probably elaborate on that a lot more eloquently than I could, somebody who's embedded in that world. But I think that's what he's talking about. And I think that's something that gets lost in the debate a lot when we focus so much on the problems in public schools and forget to think about what a benefit it is to society at large.
Sure. And as with so many things, the quality of any service really depends on the amount of investment in that service. And that pivots us into that tax conversation. The budget this year, obviously a critical conversation point, as we're less optimistic as we were in years past with a lot of that federal influx of money post-pandemic. Now we're getting back to a bit more business as usual with the tax base for our services. Another recent commentary you just put out, Seth, saying the simple solution for South Dakota's budget woes, restoring the sales tax rate. Tell us about your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought this up, because, you know, as we've been covering the legislature this session, especially when we were covering the part of the legislature where the Joint Appropriations Committee is setting revenue estimates for the next year. The absurdity of this situation just really struck me hard because, you know, we're in this situation where everybody has kind of accepted, oh, gosh, we're just going to have to make cuts. It's just a bad budget year and there's nothing we can do. But when you think about what's really happened, you know, you just go back a couple of years, and I don't want to get too long-winded on this, but there's a sort of a sweeping scale of things that got us to where we are right now, and it really started the last time then Governor Kristi Noem ran for re-election in 2022. She had a brief moment where I think she thought that her challenger then, Jamie Smith, a Democrat, maybe posed a real challenge to her. She abruptly comes out and announces her support for the Democratic position of repealing the sales tax on groceries, surprised everybody. And that set in motion a chain of events where Republican legislators really felt pressured to do something for sales tax relief, even though really there was no broad call for it. Nobody was out asking for it except for Governor Noem. And they ended up not giving her the grocery tax repeal that she wanted, but they gave her, of course, we now know, a reduction in the overall sales tax rate from 4.5% to 4.2%. And they put a sunset on that, so it'll go back up to 4.5% in 2027. And that cost the state of South Dakota more than $100 million in revenue per year. And so then you fast forward, as you mentioned, this year, we've spent all the pandemic federal aid that we got, you know, billions of dollars in federal pandemic aid. That's all gone. Sales taxes are declining. The economy's tough. There's high inflation. And so, boy, those $100 million would come in real handy right now to balance the budget. And you have legislators acting like they don't even know that they did that. You have them talking, blaming the budget problem on rising Medicaid costs and other things, and Medicaid costs are rising, but we knew that would happen. And so, you know, when you think about how absurd this all is, if they would just, all you'd have to do to solve this problem is go into the section of state law where it says the sales tax increase will sunset in 2027, you change that 7 to a 5. And all of a sudden, you'd solve the budget problem with money left to spare because you'd have more than $100 million of extra revenue, which is more than is needed to close the gap that we have in ongoing revenue and ongoing expenses. Is that going to happen? No, it doesn't look like it. But I just wanted to point out that you know, this stuff doesn't happen in a vacuum. There's no mystery on why this is a tight budget year. There are economic factors and things like that. But it's also, as I said in the commentary, because legislators essentially flushed $100 million down the toilet 2 years ago, and they don't have that money now. So as you can see, I'm a little riled up about it.
Well, I think it's a worthwhile conversation, and I apologize. I don't have the bill number off the top of my head, but there was a bill discussed from Dybert related to property taxes, which was really kind of the goal of this legislation. But the procedure was more or less to bring the sales tax rate back to that sales tax cut rate that we had, to essentially do, as you said, change that 26 to a 2025 in the sunset clause, and then funnel about $100 million into property taxes directly versus letting that sunset go through and then having those dollars go back to the general fund to be dealt with from there. And that bill didn't make it through. Seemingly would have addressed some of the property tax issues. Now, granted, I know there's a lot of property tax policy at play. That was just one conversation I happened to listen in on. But I guess in kind of our closing moments, if there's anything you would want to say about really the sales tax, the property tax, these ongoing conversations of what we're going to do now.
Well, yeah, of course, another thing I mentioned in my commentary was the fact that, you know, while nobody was asking for sales tax relief, and I'm exaggerating there, maybe, but for the most part, nobody was asking for sales tax relief a couple of years ago. Lots of people were asking for property tax relief, but inexplicably, the legislature got fixated, largely because of Governor Noem calling for it, on doing something with sales tax, and they let the property tax problem fester to the point that now it's really a political liability for a lot of legislators, and they feel like they have to do something with it. So I'm not sure why. You know, you mentioned the idea to raise the sales tax back up to where it was and use that revenue for property tax relief. that doesn't seem to really be going anywhere. I mean, maybe it still will. I mean, a lot of stuff are still in play with property taxes, but, you know, of course, Governor Roden came out with his plan, which doesn't include an increase in the sales tax rate, so that's had a big influence on things. I'm not sure why, you know, again, because, again, to point to the absurdity of all this, the sales tax is going to go back up to 4.5% in 2027 if the legislature doesn't act to prevent that. So, I mean, one way or another, it's at this point, it's going to happen. You know, but there doesn't seem to be an appetite to make that happen a year or two earlier. I'm not exactly sure why. I know it's not popular to increase sales taxes, but, you know, we did it with a Republican governor and Republican legislature in 2016 when they raised it to 4.5%. It's already set to increase again in 2027. But, you know, this is politics and this is the legislature and things get complicated and here we are.
Things get complicated. Here we are, and still a few more days to go before the answers become clear. Seth Tupper is editor-in-chief of South Dakota Searchlight. You can find this conversation and more about local politics on our podcast feed. Just search SDPB's Dakota Political Junkies wherever you get your podcasts. Seth, thanks for your time. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Jackie Hendry, in today for Lori Walsh. We're checking in with a couple South Dakota lawmakers ahead of crossover day, so I'm sitting down now with Representative Puri Poirier down in the SDN Communications Studio in Pierre. Poirier is a representative for District 27, which covers the counties of Bennett, Jackson, Oglala Lakota, and Pennington. Representative, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Why don't we start just with an overall look at this is a very different year for the 100th mm-hmm. legislative session. A lot of changes, a lot of new faces. Why don't you just kind of give us your perspective on how the legislative session has gone so far?
Well, the makeup of it is totally different. I mean, you could look from afar and say that Republicans have a supermajority. But there are Republicans who stand and see their worldview in a different lens, and it's really interesting this year. This year, I am sitting right in the middle of that, and it's interesting, and I like to hear both sides of every story. The other part of it is it's the 100th year, and I'm excited of what we can accomplish together. I think if we focus on our common goals, local control, land, protecting our children, and really having a more critical conversation regarding what does criminal justice reform look like in South Dakota and what do we want to see for the next 100 years. I think that's a critical conversation. It's something that we really need to have here in the Capitol.
Yeah, and that's ongoing in a lot of different conversations. Why don't we start with the prison? We know that that's been a big topic as far as the expense, as far as different perspectives on the need for that new prison. Where do you stand on that issue right now?
Well, on the first page of the prison report, the first sentence says, in the executive summary, it says, you know, paraphrasing, minus any significant criminal justice reform, here are your prison plans, here are your options. And I think that was the most important part of that report, is significant criminal justice reform. I think we need to start having that conversation. One, we have an invested interest in our community to make sure that we are addressing issues, mental health issues, substance abuse, substance addiction disorders. We need to look at it through a different lens because what we're doing right now isn't working. And we don't want a bigger prison. We don't want a supermax prison in South Dakota. We want to be able to let communities come together and really help address these needs rather than just having one solution, which is let's do a supermax and let's just fill it. And I'm not saying that our judges do that, but what I am saying is that when we are lawmakers, I sit on House Judiciary, so I see it all the time, lawmakers who are tough on crime, they want to make harder laws. They want to make more felonies. And that strategy of, we're gonna stack the felonies against you so that you will negotiate for a lesser charge, it's not working anymore. We have to address the root causes of why people commit crimes. Yes, there's always gonna be a portion of our population that are gonna be violent, but we need to have an equal lens, but we also need to have fair and a balanced approach by it, because that right now, that's the only solution that South Dakota is coming up with, is a supermax prison, and it has more beds than we need. So when you look at the trajectory of incarceration rates, it goes higher and higher and higher. So that's why they want to build a 100-year huge prison, because they don't want to address the crime rates. And they, I mean people who support this type of maneuver. And I spoke out against on the floor, and I strongly am in very much disagreement. These are people who are in our communities. These are relatives. These are friends. These are family members. The Native American community knows this so much, and we know the heartbreak behind it, but these are also somebody's son, somebody's daughter, and we have victims and perpetrators on both sides. It affects us, but we still need to talk about reform. That still needs, let's have justice, let's be firm when we need to be, but when we don't need to be, in those areas of gray, like ingestion, let's get people help instead of just putting them in prison with a felony.
Say more about that ingestion. We'll start there for a reform conversation. I know that's a bill that's been moving through the process this year and has in past years as well. It seems to be going farther, that conversation this year. Talk to me about how ingestion might further that reform of the criminal justice system that we need to see.
I think the conditions for it to have that conversation is better this year. We can have a conversation of what is ingestion and what can we do better by addressing those? Why is somebody caught with something in their system? And what leads to that? And let's have an alternative approach of how we look at substance abuse. Substance abuse largely can be attributed to a chemical imbalance of the brain. I mean, the prison secretary, she went on the record and says that whenever someone comes into my custody, by federal law, I have to look at substance abuse as a disorder, as a medical disorder. So if that's where it changes when you get to prison, we should be looking at it before you get to prison. And that's what's important about that bill, and that's why I signed on to that bill, because it's very important. And I feel like we're gonna have favorable conditions this year, just because the makeup and the conversations are completely different than in the past.
Do you think that change is due to the influx of new lawmakers that we're seeing this session, or is that because our understanding of the issue is changing, or a combination? What do you think is contributing to those more favorable conditions for that conversation?
The conversations that I've had with a number of my colleagues, I see a push to change the way we understand substance abuse. I've had a lot more conversations this year regarding an understanding that substance abuse needs to be changed drastically. We need to change the way we look at it. And I'm optimistic, because we do have so many new legislators, and I know what it's like to be a new legislator. You're green, but you don't care. You're still gonna push through and pass bill or attempt to pass bills, and you're gonna learn the system, and it's always trial by fire. But I'm confident that we can have a different look, a different way of thinking in this 100 years.
Mm-hmm. Before I let you go, I want to give you the chance to talk about the Buffalo Caucus and what that looks like in session this year.
You know, there's always been a low-key Buffalo Caucus. There's always been this presence of legislators who are tribal citizens, and they have the lived experience of what that entails, and they bring that knowledge and experience to the state capitol. It's always been there, but Senator Foster and I want to take it a step further and just be an official caucus. We want to explore, what does this mean? What would our values look like? What would our platform look like? And let's explore, let's bring all of our elders together. I spoke to an elder this morning, and this was always a part of a conversation, that the tribal nations, the indigenous people in South Dakota, the Native Americans, we have to come into a unified stance in the political process. We should be organizing and solidifying our power base, not under a political party that exists today. We need to be creating our own. We need to be able to stand on our own beliefs and our issues that align with what we see as huge challenges facing Indian country today. And this is the time to do it. And I'm excited that we can make some headway if we can hold our representation unencumbered by any political affiliation. Because we are not Republicans, we are not Democrats. We are the Pateoyate. We come from the Buffalo Nation, and that's a part of our story, that's part of who we are. And so for us to say, we're gonna stand on our issues and we're gonna solve our issues in our own type of platform, I'm excited of what that could bring, and I'm excited of what kind of challenges could be solved. It would bring us all together, and we would figure out how do we best accomplish what we need to so that our kids will have a better future. Because right now, we have serious challenges when it comes to our children. Children who have nobody, they don't grow up to be scientists. They don't grow up to be engineers. There's a certain pathway for them. They get taken advantage of, they get exploited, and there's a place for them. It's not in college. And I hope that we don't make our capacity bigger so they could fill it.
Representative Pree Poirier from District 27, I want to thank you for your time today.
Thank you.
That was our show for the day. We hope that it served you. In the Moment is produced by Ellen Kester and Ari Youngeman. Our videographer is Jordan Henderson. Our engineer is Colton Nicholson. And our host is Lori Walsh. I'm Jackie Hendry. From all of us here at SDPD, thank you for listening.